Hello, folks. Welcome to a special edition of Labor Relations Information Systems First Thursday podcast. My name is Will Aitchison. As you know, from time to time, we interview a leading practitioner in the field. And this month, we have somebody very special for you. You may have seen a bit of a story that circulated on the Caliber Press newsletter a while back about some advice that Scott Wood, an attorney in Oklahoma, was suggesting that people think about with respect to whether officers should invoke the Fifth Amendment in the wake of a deadly force incident. Scott's advice came as a result of his experiences representing Tulsa police officer Betty Shelby, who was charged with manslaughter as a result of an officer-involved shooting. And I thought it would be a great idea to get Scott on the phone and talk this whole issue through, because I think it's really important in terms of everybody assessing their critical incident protocols. So with that, Scott, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning, Will. Thank you for having me.
First of all, just a little bit of background. Can you tell us about your background as an attorney and how it was you ended up representing Officer Betty Shelby?
Sure. I'm originally from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I was a police officer here for about 5 years in the early 80s, and then I quit and went to law school. And my practice kind of evolved into one primarily representing police officers and criminal investigations after shootings and civil rights cases involving uses of force. So Betty Shelby was an officer here in Tulsa. She'd been a deputy at Tulsa County before coming to the Tulsa Police Department. And over the 4 or 5 years that she was here, I'd represented her on a couple of just very minor investigations and got to know her. Her husband is also a Tulsa police officer. I represented him in a shooting in which he wound up getting the Medal of Valor for. So I was acquainted with the Shelby family far before the date of this incident, September 16th, 2016.
Now, Scott, you must have been in on just about the grand floor of the FOP's legal plan back in the 1980s. Is that right?
I was. The plan was rolled out, and I had heard about it. So, of course, I threw my name in the ring and became a listed plan attorney. And coincidentally, here in Tulsa, around 2002, we had a consent decree. And that required every single complaint, no matter if it was anonymous, to be investigated. So nobody wanted to go to IA without an attorney back during that time period. And as a result, I was very, very busy and got to know a lot of officers here in Tulsa and the Tulsa area.
Now, Scott, I do want to get to Betty Shelby, but you just said something that really piques my interest because it's a conversation I've had with many of our clients over the years. In a routine IA interview, routine, meaning there's no likelihood of criminal charges or we're not looking at a reasonable possibility of serious economic discipline or termination. So just your garden variety IA, my advice to my clients has been you do a better job of representing your officers than an attorney could. And the reason is, you're a police officer, you'll be talking to other police officers, you'll be able to establish a dialogue where an attorney coming into the room changes that dialogue and not always in a good way in a routine case. What's your take on that?
You know, I would agree with that to this extent. Early on, you know, if you showed up in internal affairs and you had a lawyer with you, there was almost an automatic presumption that you must have done something wrong because you have a lawyer with you. Somehow, because of the consent decree, I believe, we kind of avoided or beat that stigma into the ground because literally no one would go to Internal Affairs for, you know, a period of 3 or 4 years while this consent decree was implemented and being monitored. It was the norm for an officer to go to IA with an attorney present. But for many years, I think there was a stigma that if you showed up with an attorney, boy, you must have really, you know, screwed the pooch, did something wrong, and as a result, felt like you needed an attorney.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's turn to the Shelby incident. I know most of our listeners have heard about it. Can you give us the Reader's Digest version of what occurred that day?
Sure, you bet. You know, Officer Shelby was working the evening shift in patrol division. She was working on the north side of Tulsa, which is a higher crime area than most of the other areas in the city of Tulsa. She was just finished her lunch at the division and was heading out to back another officer who had been assigned a domestic disturbance call. So she leaves the police station and literally, this was a location of her call was in an area where she could have gone to the right and got on an expressway and headed to that call or made a left-hand turn. And she and I have talked about that before because she paused and thought about, which way should I go? And it's literally a left-hand turn that changed the course of her life. Because she turned left, headed down 36th Street North here in Tulsa, and had only driven maybe about a quarter of a mile or so. And up ahead, she can see somebody standing in the roadway, kind of just staring down at the pavement. Large, husky, black male, probably mid-30s, early 40s. And there's a car between her and this man, and as the car ahead of her approached this man, it got over into a turn lane. And then as Betty Shelby's patrol car approached this individual, he turned to the left and looked at her and then turned without ever turning away from her, his gaze at her, turned and walked to the north side of the street. She obviously believed that he was probably under the influence of something, but thought, well, he's off the roadway now. I need to go ahead and go to this domestic disturbance call. So the light changes, and she goes on through the interview, and literally she goes about 300 or 400 feet on to the west, and she sees a Lincoln Navigator that's anti-goggle across the center line. It's a two-lane asphalt street, and cars are having to kind of leave the roadway to get around it going both ways. So it's an obvious traffic obstruction that she feels like she needs to deal with. So she stops her vehicle, calls in the tag number, and then gets out to check to see if the car has any occupants or anything. Because obviously she thought because of the location of the car that it must have been disabled or broken down. She gets out of the car, and as soon as she shuts her door, she notices that the car is running. So this kind of makes her be a little bit more cautious about approaching the vehicle. Some of the things that crossed her mind was maybe a rolling domestic where somebody jumped out of the car and the driver jumped out to chase him, a drive-by shooting. So she's pretty cautious as she walks up on the car and goes to the left rear corner of the vehicle, looks in the back cargo area, nothing there, clears the back seat, clears the front seat. And she's getting ready to walk around to the passenger side of the car. And when she turns to do that, she sees this individual that she'd seen at the intersection about a minute or so before walking westbound on the north side of the street, kind of approaching the rear of her patrol vehicle. So she turns and she thinks, okay, this is this guy's car, and says, sir, is this your vehicle? If so, we need to get it moved. And the individual, who turns out to be Terrence Crutcher, mumbles a few words, and kind of lowers his head and just looks at her kind of under her brow. He's a rather large man, and he keeps approaching Officer Shelby. So she tells him, "Hey, you need to take your hands out of your pocket. I need to talk to you. Is this your car?" He mumbles something else and does not immediately comply with taking his hands out of his pocket. But as he gets closer to her, she kind of flanks out, taking a little bit more tactical position and keeping some distance between him and her. And he then is told again, "I need to see your hands." And he takes his hands out of his pockets for a second and then puts them back in. She gives him another command. And then all of a sudden, he raises his hands above his head without having been ordered to, and just looks at her. She is then quite alarmed. She believes he could have something in his pocket because, as we all know, as police officers, people that are carrying weapons will continually touch or go to them. And so that's what was going through her mind. So she ordered him to get down on his knees at the rear of her patrol car. She also got on the radio and told the dispatcher to hold traffic, and that's when people started heading towards her. He did not comply. He walked along the passenger side of her car and then got up to the front corner, passenger's corner of her patrol car, and then looked at her. And by this time, she could hear sirens in the background coming from the east, and she believed coming as a result of her radio call to hold traffic. Mr. Crutcher kind of leans back so he can look past Officer Shelby as if to measure the distance that these oncoming patrol cars are away from them, then looks back at his vehicle, and then with his hands still in the air, takes off walking towards the Lincoln Navigator. And it was about this time, about the time he departed the front of the police car, is when the helicopter, Police One, got on scene and started videotaping. Oddly enough, the observer in that helicopter was Betty Shelby's husband, Dave. So Mr. Crutcher is now walking towards the vehicle, and Betty Shelby is yelling at him, "Stop, stop, do not go to your vehicle, stop where you are." Mr. Crutcher ignores all of those commands, walks to the driver's side door, faces the door, then looks back at where Officer Shelby is. She's now at the rear driver's corner of the Lincoln Navigator, and unbeknownst to her, some other officers have just pulled up. And she, they stay behind her, so she doesn't realize she has anyone with her yet. And Mr. Crutcher looks at her. We called it or categorized it as targeting her, and then stuck his left hand through the window of the vehicle, causing Officer Shelby to fire one round, which struck Mr. Crutcher in the right side, penetrating his lung and his heart. An officer who had just arrived and was closest to her at the same time, within a fraction of a second or possibly the same time, discharged his taser. She saw that our Officer Turnbow was his name, Tyler Turnbow. He recognized that Officer Shelby had lethal force, so he wanted to cover with less than lethal and had his taser out. And he did strike Mr. Crutcher, but it was not ever confirmed that there was a good connection. Turnbow believed he had effectively tased him, but the physical evidence didn't bear that out later. But in any event, Mr. Crutcher goes down to the ground, and the police helicopter pilot is narrating and starting to direct people in. Within about 4 or 5 seconds, Officer Shelby gets on the radio and calls out, "Shots fired."
Now, criminal charges are filed against her, correct? If I remember right, manslaughter charges?
Yes, you are correct. And, you know, which was quite shocking to me. This same district attorney's office had cleared an officer about 18 months before this shooting that was a black male inside of a house where a search warrant was being served, refused commands to turn around and take his hands out of the pocket of his hoodie. And he was shot and killed in the back, and the district attorney cleared that police sergeant here in Tulsa on those charges. So when I first got contacted and heard, actually it was Officer Turnbow that called me first and told me what had happened. I'd represented Turnbow several times on other events, including not a deadly shooting, but he had to stab somebody that was trying to take his gun a couple of years before, so I knew Turnbow very well. And he told me, kind of ran through the basic fact pattern, and man, I thought from the get-go that this was going to be a standard routine shooting investigation, with the officer being cleared within a week or two.
Now, ultimately, I do want to get to the jury instruction, but ultimately you do go to the jury in this case. What does the jury do?
Yeah, you know, the trial was a little bit of a disappointment with the district attorney's office, not just from the perspective that they charged Officer Shelby, but the way in which they tried the case. Well, for about probably at least, I'd say, 8 to 10 years, the Tulsa Police Department had what I would call was down with the program on post-officer-involved shooting protocols. They knew that any officer that was represented by me was not going to give a statement for at least a couple of days. Of course, we'd give a public safety statement if it was warranted. And even when I was unable to come to a scene, the officer would be taken to a nearby division, photographed, had his sidearm replaced, if that's what they used in the shooting, and was given an administrative order of leave with pay while the investigation went on. And then, you know, 2 or 3 days later, I'd take the officer in and give a complete statement regarding the shooting. So, you know, it was all peaches and cream. We thought we were working together very, very effectively. And in this particular case, I happened to be out of town in Oklahoma City at my son's high school football game when this shooting occurred. So I managed it all by telephone. Everything seemed like it was going just as it should. And sure enough, this shooting was about probably 7:40 in the evening. And by midnight, Officer Shelby and her husband are on their way home. So during the trial, the prosecution started attacking the fact that Shelby did not make a statement that evening. And, of course, they could have spoken up about that on the dozens and dozens of shootings that they'd been involved in reviewing over the years, but never had until this particular case. So what they did is they moved for a jury instruction that basically let the jury weigh Officer Shelby's believability or credibility by considering the fact that she did not give a statement on the night of the shooting.
Let's stop for a moment. I'm sure pretty much everybody's heard the phrase jury instruction. What purpose does a jury instruction serve in a trial?
Well, whether it's a criminal case or a civil case, a jury is tasked with determining what facts of the case are true or untrue, or proven or not proven. And so the purpose of a jury instruction is to tell the jury what law is to be applied to the facts as they determine and how those facts can or cannot be used in applying the facts to the law. So the judge, he has a duty to apply the proper law to the case. The jury applies the facts that they find to that law as given to them by the judge.
And what instruction did the judge end up giving with respect to the delay in Officer Shelby's statement?
Yeah, this is kind of just by memory, but I've gone over it so many times, I think I can tell you. The instruction said something along the lines that evidence has been introduced that the defendant did not make a formal statement to police on September 16, 2016. This evidence is called impeachment evidence, and it is offered to show that the defendant's testimony is not believable or truthful. You may consider this impeachment evidence in determining what weight and credit to give to the credibility of the defendant. You may not consider this impeachment evidence as proof of innocence or guilt. You may consider this impeachment evidence only to the extent that you determine it affects the believability of the defendant, if at all. So basically, they can't say, well, she didn't give a statement, she must be guilty. But they can say, well, why didn't she give a statement that night? Was it because she wanted to wait and watch the video and see if she could get her statement to match up with what the video showed? Or was she trying to think of a lie? Or a lot of different things that the Supreme Court, in a case from 2013, Salinas versus Texas, says that people can be doing when they simply are silent and don't give a statement.
Well, I think just about every law enforcement officer has received training in a police academy that whenever they get on the stand and testify, they have to be assiduously careful not to comment on a defendant's failure to give a statement out at the scene. And of course, prosecutors are taught never to comment on a defendant's failure to take the stand during a criminal trial. How does this instruction square with that sort of training that people get under the Fifth Amendment?
Well, look, I'm in that same camp, too. When I was a police officer, I knew people didn't have to talk to me if they didn't want to. But what I never realized is that that kind of silence might be used against you. And it's very, very clear from the Salinas versus Texas case from the United States Supreme Court 2013 that your Fifth Amendment right to remain silent is not automatically activated. It's not something that kind of just floats in the air over your head and is there whenever you fall silent. You have to actively invoke that right by saying something like, I'm invoking my Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. So in the scenario that we've been operating under, where the Tulsa Police Department and other agencies around here, the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation is tasked with investigating a lot of officer-involved shootings here in the state, especially at smaller agencies, we've all operated under the notion that, okay, we're not going to give a statement. It's just kind of understood. The lawyer for the officer will call us in a couple of days, and then we'll set it up. But in this case, and I think it was pretty evil of the prosecution to try and use such a jury instruction to attack the believability of Officer Shelby.
I'm really trying hard to wrap my head around this. And Scott, I'm not a criminal defense lawyer. I'm a labor lawyer who hasn't been in criminal court in over 30 years. But the notion of such an instruction that is, I think, an explicit comment on the credibility of a criminal defendant because of the criminal defendant's silence, the notion of such an instruction seems very, very odd to me.
Well, I'll be honest with you. It blew my mind. I couldn't wrap my head around it either until, you know, we started looking at the case law, and I started thinking about how do I keep this from ever happening again? And just to go back, you know, here's what the Salinas court said about whether there's a probable explanation for silence after an incident occurs. The court said, to be sure, someone might decline to answer a police officer's question in reliance on his constitutional privilege, but he also might be doing so because he was trying to think of a good lie, because he is embarrassed, or because he is protecting someone else. Not every such possible explanation for silence is probative of guilt, but neither is every possible explanation protected by the Fifth Amendment. So, I mean, that's from our own Supreme Court. So, like I said a minute ago, I was quite shocked at this. I thought we need to find a remedy for this and let all officers know about it and all police defense attorneys know about it so no one else has to deal with the jury instruction like we did in the Shelby case.
And I don't want to pin you down if you don't want to be pinned down here, but I hear you saying that there's actually support for this instruction in the Salinas case.
Absolutely. The Salinas case involved a guy who was at a party and there was a shooting. A bunch of people flee. The police find out that Salinas had been there, not necessarily that he was a suspect, and he voluntarily starts talking to him. And then when they ask him about some shotgun shells and whether they might match the shotgun that he has, he just quits talking. He doesn't say, I want a lawyer. He doesn't say, I invoke my Fifth Amendment right. He just falls silent. And later he was charged. And at his trial, he also had such an instruction used against him. And so that was the genesis of that case and what caused the appeal all the way to the Supreme Court. And it's pretty clear black letter law now. Unless you invoke your right and you're just silent, your silence could be used against you.
Now, I do want to tease this out just a little bit. The U.S. Supreme Court only decides what the rules are under the U.S. Constitution or interpreting federal statutes or federal regulations or some sort of federal law.
That is correct.
It's up to state courts to interpret their own state constitutions and common law, and it can be that a state constitution is more protective of the rights of citizens than the federal constitution is.
That is absolutely right, and in fact, there are several states that pride themselves in written opinions that such is the case. Oklahoma is one of those, but apparently not in this area because the criminal jury instructions in the Shelby case were based on Oklahoma law.
Fascinating. I have clients in both Alaska, or in all of Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and California. All four states have independent state constitutional law jurisprudence that might come into play here. But there's a lot of states where federal law is it, and the state constitutions are construed in a fashion identical to the federal constitution.
Correct.
It sounds to me like your off-the-cuff advice, and by the way, I haven't mentioned that in this podcast, nobody gives any legal advice, right?
That's
and everybody needs to rely on their own attorneys.
But that is absolutely correct.
But your off-the-cuff lay advice to everybody would be, hey, unless you see some reason not to, invoke right away.
Right, absolutely. And what I've been having my clients do, I've had two shootings in the last couple of days, and in both cases told the officers to tell the investigator, I'm invoking my Fifth Amendment right to remain silent under the United States Constitution and the case of Salinas versus Texas. And then I have a little form now that I will have the officer sign to that effect and give it to the investigator and ask that it be placed in the investigative file.
Now, Scott, I've impinged too much on your time already, so I do want to wrap this up. What happened to Betty Shelby's employment after she was acquitted, right, by the jury?
She was. She was acquitted on May 17th of last year, and she got all of her back pay. As soon as she got charged, she was suspended without pay. And then after she was acquitted, she was reinstated, given an inside job just based on security, her own personal security, and at which she was very, very unhappy. And so she resigned around the first part of August last year and then became a reserve deputy in a nearby county, Rogers County, Oklahoma, and a great friend of law enforcement, great leader in law enforcement here in Oklahoma, Sheriff Scott Walton, put her in his reserve program. And then she became a full-time deputy a few months later and is now back working the streets again and is extremely happy, and the citizens of Rogers County are very happy to have her there.
Well, Scott, I really want to thank you for this interview. You've actually shocked me with the information that you're giving, and I am guessing that lawyers in our position, lawyers who respond to officer-involved shootings and other critical incidents, I'm guessing an awful lot of them would be shocked by what happened in that courtroom in Tulsa. And I think we've all got to start thinking how we're going to approach these things, and everybody's got to dust off Salinas versus Texas and take a look at it. You've given us tremendous food for thought. So, Scott, thank you, and congratulations on the result in the Shelby case.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed visiting with you, and thank you for everything you've done for law enforcement.
Okay. Have a good day.
All right. You too. Bye-bye.